Fatal Mistake, a Harry Hell novella by Mark McNeice. Copyright Made Mark Publishing. Narration provided by Wondervox. Chapter 1. The only light in the slopes was the burn from Echo's cigarette floating midair in the passenger seat of the abandoned car they'd been sitting in for the past 2 days. The interior had a lingering corpse odor to it, which Crater attributed to the decomposed body they'd found in the trunk. Whoever it was had met their death a long time ago and had become a tangle of bones, dried flesh, and rat-eaten cloth. Crater guessed it had not found its way into the trunk on its own. They ate in the front seat, slept in the back seat on rotation, and only left to relieve themselves in a nearby alley that smelled like the open toilet it was. The area's daily ration of power had been provided and consumed well before midnight, leaving this entire section of the island in darkness. Nobody cared what happened after that, or really what happened at all, in this part of what had once been a great city. People who lived in the slopes were several steps down from the ones who lived in the ruins, which was like going from lower to lowest. Life in either place was comparable to an overcrowded prison without walls. Everybody lived by their wits if they had them, and even those who did could expect a short run. "Harry told you not to smoke," Crater said. "Put it out." "Nobody can see us," Echo replied, taking another defiant drag. He'd snatched the pack of cigarettes, considered treasure, from a body they'd come across on a recent scavenge. Sometimes the deceased had been living people before they met Crater and Echo, but someone had already taken the pleasure of killing this one. It stank from several days of rotting, and the clothing did not make it clear if it had been a man or a woman. Echo didn't care. There was a half pack of crushed cigarettes in the back pants pocket that might as well be gold. That he'd made them last this long was a testament to his willpower, or to his desperation, depending on how you saw it. Cigarettes were hard to come by and seldom acquired without violence. "I'll let Harry know you don't mind what he says, you don't follow instructions." "You do that." Demonstrating that his bravado was not as sure as he'd wanted it to be, Echo tossed the cigarette out his open window. "Fuck Harry anyway," Echo said, his impatience getting the best of him. He was tired of waiting for their elusive prey to show herself. "She's not here. We're wasting our time." Crater, so named because of the facial acne scars he'd had since his teenage years, ignored his partner. He knew without Harry Hell, they would both be dead, killed long ago by someone stronger, meaner, quicker. Harry had recognized their usefulness and given them purpose, to serve him without question. In exchange, he let it be known in all the slopes and from one side of the ruins to the other that Crater and Echo were his men. Do not touch them. Do not cross them. For to cross them was to cross Harry himself, and that was as certain a death sentence as any they could receive. They'd been on stakeout at Harry's orders. Word had gotten to him that Nectar was seen coming and going among the buildings on this block, and she'd been alone. A queen venturing out from her hive for reasons only she knew. The large woman who was usually seen shadowing her, a protectress or a servant or both, had not been with her. The directive had been simple. Find Nectar and confirm to Harry immediately that she was there. They'd been given a cell phone with only one number to dial, recharged each day during the power share, and kept off at all other times except when they watched and waited. Harry would do the rest and end her life after trying for 5 years to get close enough for the kill. "Why can't we do it ourselves?" Echo asked. "Think of what people would say about us then." Echo and Crater caught the mighty Nectar. "Maybe we could tie her up, torture her a little. I've got my pick. 1,000 little punctures would do the trick, nice and slow. She's never been caught, and she's never been tied up, except by fools who didn't live to brag about it. She's a chick." "And you're a moron," Crater said. "Calling Nectar a chick is like calling a cobra a garden snake." "What's a cobra?" Echo asked him, leaning his head out the window to get a whiff of his still-burning cigarette. "It's a killer," said a voice. Startled, Echo lifted his head to peer into the darkness outside, just as a knife slit his throat. It happened so fast he didn't know what had been done to him. He tried to speak as he felt a wet gush of blood surging from his neck. Crater shifted in the driver's seat, staring at Echo as he tried to pull his head back into the car. The gash in his throat caught on the window's ledge, sending a thick stream of blood down the inside door. Panicking, Crater reached for the phone they kept on the dash. "Don't," said the voice, this time from just outside Crater's window. "She's so fast," he thought. His hand stopped short of the small black phone. A second later, he felt the tip of a very sharp knife pressed into his neck just below his left ear. "Let me guess, Harry Hell sent you?" Crater nodded, afraid that if he spoke, the words would be his last. His eyes shifted slightly, trying to get a look at the woman outside his window. "Don't look at me," she said. "Most people who look at me don't live to describe what they saw. I'm kind of like God that way." Crater thought of praying, but who would he pray to? And who would listen? The souls of the men he'd killed? The devil? That was impossible. She was holding a knife to his neck. "You're slow and stupid," she said. "Tell Harry I said that." His eyes widened slightly. Was she going to let him go? "Tell Harry to come himself next time. I'd rather kill him than some lackey foolish enough to smoke a cigarette in a pitch black car. Not a smart move." "God damn you, Echo," he thought. And for a moment his fear was mixed with sadness. He'd been with his dead, witless friend for many years. Their lives together concluded with a slit throat on a cold, dark, empty street in the slopes. It was bound to end this way, though, wasn't it? Had Nectar not finished them, someone less deadly, for there was no one more deadly except Harry, would have done the job. "Does that mean I'm not killing you?" "Yes, that's what it means. I torture you, but I'm on a schedule. I need you to give Harry a message." "Sure thing." "Sure thing," she said, mocking him. "Tell him you met Nectar face to face, or knife to throat, and she saw you coming long before you got here. Tell him Raoul is still dead, and I enjoyed killing him. Like I'll enjoy killing Harry when we finally meet again. But that will be on my terms, in my time. And tell him not to send any more losers looking for me." He felt the knife withdraw from his flesh. "I can't be found." He did not hear her leave. She was too quick, too silent. She was as terrifying as her legend, a ghost among the living. He waited several minutes, staring straight ahead into the darkness. Finally, his hand trembling, he reached for the phone. This would not be an easy call. Depending on Harry's reaction, it may be his last. He pressed a button and listened as a phone rang. "Harry," the familiar voice said. It was a cold voice, the voice of a man who'd survived against the odds and grown harder for it, hard as rock, hard as frozen lava. "Echo's dead," Crater said. "We failed." He passed on the message from Nectar, feeling, imagining, the chill when he repeated her words about Raoul. Harry asked no questions and offered no response. He'd been given the message. The phone went dead. Chapter 2. Harry sat in his loft in the ruins thinking about the call he'd just received. He'd wanted to be told something else, that they'd verified her location with a sighting and the time of reckoning had come. That's not the message Crater had conveyed, nor was Harry surprised to find out it had ended so differently. If he was honest with himself, and he always was, he'd known there was a good chance Nectar would see them before they saw her. She had eyes everywhere. Devotees anxious to please their master, in the slopes, in the ruins, everywhere. The only real surprise was that she hadn't killed them both. It had taken 5 years just to get this close to her again. She relied on her legend as much as her skills to stay ahead of him. The only thing as dangerous as crossing Nectar was crossing Harry Hell, and that pressure of equal and opposing forces had sustained their stalemate. It would not, could not last forever. His one promise left in life, his mission, was to extinguish her like a candle blown out with his own breath, to watch her die as he spoke one word, one name, Raoul, his only soulmate in a lifetime littered with souls, the real reason he'd stayed alive this long. For the truth is that Harry had tired of living long ago. The world he existed in had refused to save itself, and he was weary of inhabiting it. There were no morals, no hope, and absolutely no redemption. He had not committed to killing Nectar for anything as grand as justice. There was no justice, and never had been, except in the minds of people for whom the futility of life was unbearable. Rather, his determination was for revenge and the satisfaction of it. Raoul had given him comfort in a world devoid of it. Raul had made him feel human when humanity had abandoned the planet and the people on it. Raul had made him laugh. He had not laughed since Raul's death. He had not even smiled. But he would smile as he watched Nectar's eyes go dull, and as he heard her gasp a last breath, and as he smelled her fear. People imagined she had none, but Harry knew better. Everyone fears. These are things he'd promised himself, and they were why he would never give up until one of them, or both of them, were dead. He would happily die with her as long as she went first. Harry Hell was in his 40s, past the life expectancy of anyone living in the slopes or the ruins. Only those in the vast guarded compound called Eastward, Eastie for quick reference, could expect to live longer, but not by much. The air was barely breathable anywhere on the planet, and even with their artificial environment and their miles of fencing topped with razor wire sharp enough to remove a man's fingers if he merely brushed against it, the security and comfort enjoyed by the residents of Eastie were relative. They depended on staying safely removed from the rest of the island by force, and by the generosity of providing daily food and power rations that decreased each year, a sort of cost of living in reverse. Eventually, they would stop placating the dead-enders beyond their fortified gates, for no other reason than that they had nothing left to throw to the crowds, no meat for the hyenas, and the world they all still tenuously shared would end, as all worlds do. That was the true apocalypse, the unavoidable crash and burn that, like the sun's inevitable supernova, would wipe them all from memory. Harry would be long gone by then and didn't care. He wasn't interested in saving a world that wasn't worth saving, only in making sure he'd sent one woman, one creature, to her death before he joined her in the ashes. The scars on his face itched. It was part of his physical reality, something he'd lived with since being splattered with acid 10 years ago in a capture that had almost killed him. He'd worked for control then, the last time he'd believed in anything but his own survival. The agency of ultimate authority known simply as Control, the enforcement arm of Eastward and its ruling elite, had convinced men and women like Harry that order could be restored, that the devastation they'd witnessed following the Great Collapse was temporary, and all it would take was apprehending those it deemed enemies of the estate, after which Control would determine their fate on a case-by-case basis or, in some instances, mass extinction. It had not been Harry's job to always kill his targets, although execution was as acceptable to Control as bringing them back alive. In most cases, Control considered a corpse as good as a man or woman in handcuffs, and less expensive too. Dead people did not consume resources, and Harry had delivered more than a few lifeless bodies to his superiors. But there were other times when someone was considered so dangerous or such a valuable source of information that Control wanted them brought back alive for questioning that would postpone their inevitable deaths. It was during one such mission to bring a rogue agent back that Harry had almost forfeited his life. That time he'd been surprised, something Harry knew was usually fatal in the game of predator and prey he'd mastered so well. It had been Raul, then just his hunting partner, who'd saved his life at the expense of the man they'd gone to capture. The man had been third on Control's list of most wanted, a traitor who'd become a leader of incursions into Eastie to commit theft and sow chaos. Harry and Raul had found him operating from an abandoned slaughterhouse, guarded by four hard men they immediately killed, two by garrote, one by knife, and one with a bullet to the left eye. It had been a child that made Harry hesitate for just a moment, and in a world this harsh, a moment was often the distance between life and death. A boy child with wet blue eyes standing in a doorway beyond which waited the man they'd come for. "Step aside, son," Harry had said. "Kill him," Raul said, several feet behind Harry, showing no mercy. He knew as well as Harry that childhood was no guarantee of innocence and that the youngest ones were sometimes the most deadly. Harry turned to Raul, taking his attention off the child, which was all the time it took for the boy to run up to Harry and fling a jar of acid at him. The liquid fire splashed onto Harry's arm and face, and his flesh began to melt. A gunshot rang out, and the boy's head exploded. "How's it feel, motherfucker?" The man they'd come for stood in the room beyond, visible now through the doorway. He was the one who'd shot the child, useless to him now. He wasn't much of a man either, filthy clothes, thin as a belt, smiling with only half his teeth left. The door slammed shut. "Go!" Harry shouted, expecting Raoul to burst through the door in pursuit, but Raoul did not go. Raoul rushed instead to Harry. He eased Harry down onto the concrete floor, yanked his canteen from his waist belt, and poured the precious water over Harry's face and arm. It wasn't much, but it made the difference between scars and no skin at all. The thin man had got away to continue his raids another day. Mistakes were unacceptable. Control terminated their contract, and Harry got Raoul. Partners became lovers, lovers became one. They settled into a life of renegades, and for the next 5 years, they lived on commissions. Control weren't the only ones looking for scalps. Capturing enemies was a lucrative business. It didn't matter to them whose enemies they were going after, only that those enemies were guilty. They did not hunt innocent people. They sought out rapists, pedophiles, and criminals of the hardest kind, and they were paid well. Then came their biggest offer. Bring us the head of Nectar, or her hand, or any irrefutable proof she was dead, and we will pay you enough to never hunt again. She had been number one on Control's list and had become such an obsession for the agency that they were willing to hire the best, even if the best were two men they'd sworn never to employ again. Harry and Raoul hesitated and debated the offer. Could they trust Control after having been spurned by them for so long? Was it a trap of some kind? After discussing it for several days, they decided to accept the offer. They were worn out. They wanted to retire, as it were, to life in the ruins without worry or need. One more capture, one more score, and they could spend what years they had left loving each other and watching with detachment while the world disintegrated. They'd come close to apprehending her, within breathing distance, but this time their adversary did not slam a door or run or rely on a child with a jar of acid to slow them down. This time she displayed her cunning and her power. Raoul paid with his life. Harry paid with his heart. And for the past 5 years, Harry had been determined that Nectar would reimburse him with her death. At least they'd found her again. Chapter 3. It was as if the planet had tired of human beings, but had not been able to rid itself of them. There were too many of the pests. Overwhelmed by a parasitic species it could not eradicate, the Earth had decided instead to starve them into submission, to deprive them of the things that had helped them survive so long and so disastrously. Breathable air, fuel for their comfort and commerce, inhabitable ecosystems. The price paid was steep, so steep the Earth itself was in stasis, alive but barely. Now it was a waiting game to see how long the humans could sustain themselves on next to nothing. It was a terrible waiting game with time on no one's side. The island had once been teeming with industry, a major city before its collapse. It had been the envy of a world that no longer existed. It had been the center of finance, politics, fashion, progress, a microcosm of civilization. It was a magnet, and like a magnet, it had attracted people like tiny metal shavings, filling up for centuries until finally it had caved in upon itself. It hadn't been alone. Every city, large and small, had crashed and burned. Modern society and everything it required to sustain itself had been sucked into deprivation like an enormous sinkhole, leaving behind it places like the ruins and the slopes. The wealthy, desperate few had managed to cling to the sides, barricading themselves in artificial communities, tossing packets of power and rations of food to the rabble outside the razor wire. Like the planet itself, they knew the odds were against them, but they bet on winning anyway. There was always extermination. The question came down to who would exterminate whom. Harry had been a child of privilege. Born Harold Hellerman, he was an identical twin to Elliot and older by 3 minutes. He was the son of Joshua and Elizabeth Hellerman and expected to enjoy a life of surplus. Joshua Hellerman had been a major figure in a financial world on the cusp of destruction, a banker whose decisions had once held more sway than those of an American president. A president could send armies to war, but a banker with nearly unlimited power could destroy countries, ruin millions of lives, or make the lucky few unimaginably wealthy, which was Joshua's true purpose in life. He was the epitome of the greed and gluttony that had doomed Homo sapiens since they'd made their way from treetops into boardrooms. It was a shock of sorts when Harry and Elliot were set upon a different path, joining Control when they were still teenagers. Their parents had sent them off to be educated and disciplined, never expecting their sons to become the creme de la creme of state-sponsored hitmen. It was an uneasy symbiosis. People like Joshua and Elizabeth needed Control to protect their advantages. Control needed people like the Hellermans to fund their de facto government, which had begun as a junta, and both needed men like Harry and Elliot to keep a deadly order. By the time the twins emerged from their mother's womb, the world the Hellermans knew was rapidly deteriorating. Rich people, wealthy nations, and city-states could amass all the gold and virtual wealth they wanted to. It would not increase the resources that made the planet livable. As societies discovered to their detriment, you cannot buy air, at least not the kind provided by the Earth in its natural processes. You cannot hoard oil when the planet has no more to remove. And you cannot manufacture synthetic water. Human beings, in the end, were as vulnerable to extinction as any other species. And many saw it as fitting that after bringing about the disappearance of countless life forms that had shared this tiny blue spot in space, it was now the humans' turn. Or so it seemed. A crucial difference between humans and all the others was the sheer tenacity of the highly intelligent bipeds to survive. Consciousness, cunning, foresight, and opposable thumbs had given people just enough of an edge to outlive the competition, with the exception of cockroaches and certain deep water organisms. It was not enough to sustain the standard of living most people were accustomed to as the world around them heated and crumbled, but it was enough to leave a significant number alive after the apocalypse. Harry was born just as humanity teetered on this edge, its fall into chaos accelerating with one crash after another. Financial markets, housing markets, grain markets, money markets, everything that had defined modern life for generations was being sucked into oblivion as Harry and his brother gasped for their first intake of air, screaming after a doctor's slap that served as a warning. Welcome to the new world. Enter at your own risk. Harry believed he had been served by the timing of his birth. Had he been born much sooner, he would have experienced life as filled with loss, something it would take Raoul's death years later to inflict upon him. He would have seen the world go from one of seeming bounty to one of dire consequences, deprivation, and hostility. By being born just as it all came crashing down, he had a certain immunity to it, an absence of nostalgia or sentiment. He did not miss what he had never known. He did not love his parents, and his father certainly did not love him. The only person before Raoul he could say he loved was Elliot, the brother and twin he shared nearly every waking moment with until fate dealt one more cruel blow in a lifetime of them. And yet, Harry did not consider himself bleak. He was not without feeling. But what he had in much greater abundance was control. He smiled at the thought. Control. They had taken him with his parents' blessing, their relief, really, and turned the brothers into killing machines. He was not in the blame game, with one exception. He did not fault others for his own faults, and he did not regret anything in his life. The dead, and the ones he'd made dead, did not trouble him. He knew that great gaping silence was the final destination for everyone. He simply sped some on their way. He sat on his haunches on the loft floor, staring out through his large plate glass window at the night. His fingers troubled the leather necklace he had worn for 5 years. The one he'd taken from Raoul's body just before he'd burned it on a pyre. He had not kept the ashes, only the necklace. He would take it off only once when he put it around the neck of the woman he had sworn to kill. She was out there. She had been found. She would be found again. He did not intend to punish Crater. The man was dull, but useful, and never hesitated to end a life on his behalf. Harry had not expected them to capture Nectar, only to find her. She moved around constantly, aware of the price on her head and of the many lesser beings who would consider her death the greatest of trophies. It was only by luck his men had found her, but she'd seen them first. She had let Crater live to deliver a message. She had been full of herself, assured and arrogant. She had made a mistake. Chapter 4. She believed she had been born on a factory floor. She could not testify to this because no one had ever verified what happened or where. It had been an event without corroborating witnesses. She only knew that her mother took an odd pleasure in insisting this is how her daughter's life began. One exceptionally hot day, long after the world had come crashing down and tens of thousands of people had fled for escape routes that were already closed, the woman named Sharon gave birth in an abandoned building and named what came out of her nectar. It was as strange a name as the circumstances of their lives. "Why did you name me Nectar?" she once asked her mother, before the woman had gone off to scavenge one more time and never returned. Nectar was still a child, possibly 10 years old, but with a sharpness of mind that would be feared among her peers, if it could be said she truly had any, by the time she killed her first man at 16. "Everything good was dead," her mother had replied, emptying her stained and stinking scavenger's bag of the half-dozen things she'd managed to take from a few corpses. Nectar remembered a lovely ruby ring pulled from a dead woman's finger. It was too big for her then, but she'd kept it until her finger grew into it, and she had worn it ever since. It was all she had left of her mother, or of the nameless dead woman. "You were the nectar of the gods," her mother had said, before laughing at the ridiculousness of it. "You were the nectar of me, daughter, the only good thing I've done in this life." It was a sentiment with which no one else would ever agree. "It doesn't sound like a real name," she'd replied, slipping the ring into the pocket of her jeans. She knew it was cheap and worthless, which was why her mother had not demanded it back. She didn't care. It was her ring now, and it would come to symbolize her past and future. Taking it from her finger, even if the finger was still attached, would become the proof demanded years later by the forces who wanted to defeat her. "You mean like Emily? Or Teresa?" her mother said. "Why would you want to go through life with a name a million other girls have? You're special. I do believe that. You deserve a special name." "What did my father think of it?" Her mother said nothing. It was one of many times Nectar had asked about her father, hoping to finally get answers. "And it doesn't matter what he thought of it," her mother finally said. "I didn't ask him. He left us. I gave birth to you alone, on a factory floor." "What did they make there again?" "Windows, girl. I've told you that before. I made windows for recreational vehicles when I wasn't much older than you are now." Nectar had no idea what a recreational vehicle was, and she had never asked. One after another, piecework. It was a shit job with shit pay. "What happened?" Her mother stared at her as if she were the dimmest child who'd ever lived. Waving her arms around, she said, "This happened to me and you and everyone else. Was my father with you?" "No, and I was glad of it. The only thing that could have made your birth worse was having that man around." Nectar didn't even know her father's name. Her mother had never called him anything but that man, and your father, when she was being generous. She had not described him in any way. Nectar had even wondered, though she would not dare ask, if her mother really knew who her father was. She'd known her mother did things for men. You had to survive through any means you could, even if providing food for your child meant trading 5 minutes of sex for it, and that it was possible her father had been one of them. "You ask too many questions," her mother had said, after turning the bag inside out to make sure she had not missed even the smallest trinket, a penny or a sequin. "It's not a good habit to have in the ruins." The area they lived in was universally known by that name. Stuck between Eastward and the slopes, it was the vast, dreadful middle where most people lived, and most of them were destined to die. Someday, it would become Nectar's queendom, the ashes over which she ruled. But then it was still in its relative infancy. People had hoped that someday, the world they knew about from stories told by shock survivors and old people would return. It would rise from the garbage heap it had become. Lights would come on and stay on again. Laughter would echo off the sides of buildings. Innocent laughter, not the phlegmy cackling of down-and-outers. People would shop again and eat in restaurants again and play musical instruments again. Life would be good. It was a bitter dream. The last time Nectar saw her mother had been a typical dusk, like all the others. When Nectar could look up and see bats taking flight, she knew it was time for Sharon to go scavenging with the others. So many, many others. It was a way of life, if it was living at all, that involved thousands of people emerging from their squats and their burned-out trucks, their empty storefronts and their dumpsters, to take whatever they could find. The treasures would be bartered for food, cigarettes, or coffee, or simply hoarded, saved like precious rubble for the day when the old world was new again. Sharon had been promising to take Nectar with her to teach her the ways of the alleys, but she'd said Nectar was still too young. "You're small for your age," Sharon had told her that evening as the sky darkened and the scavengers began to slip out. "You need to learn knifing first. You have the knife I gave you?" Nectar had patted her sock where she'd kept the small switchblade for the past few weeks. She had become proficient with it, and she looked forward to demonstrating her skill for her mother, perhaps on a rat or a belligerent boy. "Good," her mother had said. "I'll take you with me tomorrow night. How's that?" Nectar had been surprised. She'd begun to think her mother would never take her out, never instruct her in the arts of grave robbing, thievery, and self-defense. "I want that," Nectar had replied. "I'm ready." Sharon had stopped and looked at her. There was something in her lingering gaze Nectar never forgot, as if her mother had wanted to say something, but lost what it was or chosen to conceal it. "I believe you are," Sharon had said as she finished fastening her scavenge bag to her belt. "So tomorrow it is." And that was the last time Nectar saw her mother. No explanation was ever given. No body was found. Nectar was on her own.